This week we continue our consideration of 2 Samuel 19, 8 through 43, with concluding remarks and life applications from the story of Absalom's rebellion. We've been on the rebellion for months now, and it comprises one continuous story arc, so if you haven't listened to previous messages, you will be lost here. Today's message will also put an emphasis on Mephibosheth. So to get the full context on today's message, it would be best, if you haven't already, to read 2 Samuel 9 through 19, and to listen to the messages that go along with those passages, published between June 6th of 2022 and today, September 11th of 2022. The narrative of the past 10 chapters has been particularly dense, and for that reason in previous weeks we've focused a lot on the characters and the places and the things that happened. Some moral and theological applications in some passages have been pushed aside, and so this week we're going to make up for that by discussing some of those applications. Particularly, we will focus on 2 Samuel 19, 8 through 43, for which we had deeper discussion of the narrative last week. Herein, we will contemplate Mephibosheth's gratefulness in David's judgment as exemplary for modern believers, drawing comparisons to the final judgment. We will note examples of undeserved grace. We will note the importance of enjoying the good things in life while we have them, and we will also consider the dangers of crowd dynamics. Today's passage is 2 Samuel 19, 8 through 43, and if you have not read it yet, I recommend that you pause and read it now. First, I think that we should consider Mephibosheth and his attitude toward David's judgment as being an example for Christian behavior. Mephibosheth was a grandson of King Saul, David's enemy. As a descendant of the former king, Mephibosheth could have represented a threat to David's rule. There was no particular reason for David to keep Mephibosheth alive, except for his own sense of justice, and especially justice toward Mephibosheth's father Jonathan, whom David loved. Mephibosheth also was disabled in his feet. He could not walk, at least not easily or normally, and for this reason, he couldn't even really make himself of any practical use to David. But despite this, David had not only kept Mephibosheth alive, but he had given Mephibosheth a seat at his own table. The rebellion had turned all of that on its head. As David fled Jerusalem, Mephibosheth's servant Ziba reported to David that Mephibosheth had joined with David's enemies. Now, whether or not that was true is an open question, but it is my opinion that Ziba's report was false and that Mephibosheth was wrongly accused. The result is that after the war, Mephibosheth and Ziba both ended up pleading their case before the king in a contest for Saul's and Mephibosheth's disputed lands. David, unable to make a decision, split the land between them. This represented a big loss for Mephibosheth, since before the war, all of the land had been his, but Mephibosheth took this in stride. The land was of no concern to Mephibosheth, and in fact, he said that Ziba could have it all, just so long as Mephibosheth could be back with the king. Now, I don't think that the original author of this account had it in mind to make any Christian allegory here. He wasn't trying to teach us about the relationship between God and man, or a man and his neighbor. However, I do think that Mephibosheth and his mindset present to us an example of the believer's outlook on these relationships. Particularly, Mephibosheth here demonstrates the kind of grace for his neighbor and independence from the things of the world which a Christian should display. We have considered before how Mephibosheth had a long fall. He started out wealthy and potentially in line for the throne, but misfortune left him crippled and a potential enemy of the king. Our relationship to God mirrors that. Mankind also had a long fall. In the Garden of Eden, we began in the presence of God, but as a result of sin, we were separated from him. As Mephibosheth was disabled and helpless, so we are helpless to restore our relationship with God. And yet, just as David reached out to Mephibosheth and raised him up to sit at the king's table, so through Christ's work on the cross, we too can be lifted up to fellowship with God. Our relationship with God is not dependent on our merits or our efforts. Like Mephibosheth, the relationship depends entirely on the will of the stronger party. That is the analogy. Mephibosheth is to David as we are to God. But what I want to focus on here is not so much the relationship between Mephibosheth and David, as much as the relationship between Mephibosheth and Ziba, with the presumption that Ziba had wronged Mephibosheth. The conflict between the two came before David for judgment, and David's judgment went at least partially against Mephibosheth. As a result, Mephibosheth lost half of his earthly possessions. We might have expected Mephibosheth to be angry about this, but he wasn't. Instead, Mephibosheth rejoiced that the king had returned. We also have a king who has gone away, and we wait eagerly for his return. We read in Acts 1:11 that after Jesus was risen from the dead, he ascended into heaven, and that the angelic messengers standing by in white robes said, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into heaven? This Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven." We read also in Revelation 19 and 20 of things to come, how Jesus, this King of Kings, will return with the armies of heaven to judge the world. And so for a time, Mephibosheth was abused while his king was away, and he longed for a time when his king would return to issue judgment. Eventually, Mephibosheth's hopes came to fruition. The king returned, the judgment came. Mephibosheth was vindicated. However, in that judgment, grace did not go only to Mephibosheth, but also to Ziba. Ziba had wronged Mephibosheth, but he was still on the side of the king. Mephibosheth could have balked at this. He could have said, "Well, that's not fair. Ziba is the bad guy, and he doesn't deserve any grace." Well, indeed, grace is not deserved, not by Ziba or by Mephibosheth or by anyone else. Mephibosheth did not protest because he recognized that he was no more deserving of the lands that David had gifted him than Ziba was. Mephibosheth didn't deserve anything. Had David not been the gracious ruler that he was, he could have done what any other king in the ancient world would have been likely to do, and he could have killed Mephibosheth as a potential rival to the throne. Instead, David showed grace not only to Mephibosheth, but also to Ziba. And the correlation to our relationship with God and our neighbor is obvious. When Jesus comes back to judge, I am sure that there will be those people whom we will see receiving God's grace being undeserving in our eyes. We could look at them and say, "Well, this isn't fair. Based on my limited understanding of circumstances, I think that I'm the better person, and that other person doesn't deserve this the way that I do." Well, make no mistake, people who wronged you in horrible ways will receive mercy in the end, just like Ziba received grace after he wronged Mephibosheth. Like Mephibosheth, we should recognize that we also are undeserving of grace. Indeed, just as David could have killed Mephibosheth, so God could have simply chosen to throw all of us down into hell. We are crippled beggars to him, born into a sinful line of his enemy. We don't deserve a seat at the table any more than our opponents do. And indeed, the graces that we receive are not only graces in the life to come, but graces given to man in this life as well. God sees fit to give good things to mankind in this life, and none of those things are deserved. So as long as God chooses to give us what we need, we should not begrudge others who might, by chance, get more or better things than we do. Here again, Mephibosheth is an example to us. Mephibosheth had a singular focus. He was focused on the return of the king. He was focused on the blessing of eating at the king's table. And so he wasn't worried about lands that he could not even take hold of. We also should put our highest focus on the higher things. When we suffer injustices, we should take comfort in remembering that our king will return, and when he does return, we will dine at his table, and we will not remember the lands that we lost and left behind. Like Mephibosheth, we will say, "Let him take it all, since my lord the king has come home." For Mephibosheth and for us, it should be easy to let go of the things that we have lost when we are able to focus on the things that we will receive. I will issue that with a caveat, though. I want to be clear that I am not endorsing injustice in the world. We cannot take this so far that we separate it from the context of the whole of Scripture, which emphasizes morality and the implementation of just laws to support that morality and to ensure the best interests of the just. We should not just ignore injustices and allow wrongdoing to go unchecked. We should not reward bad behavior. We should all work for justice. My point is that when we do suffer injustice, we should take comfort in looking to a time when those injustices will fade away and we will be welcomed into a better state. And when it comes to getting undeserved graces, this passage has more examples than one. Shimei and Himham also represent to us people who received grace at the return of the king. Now, Shimei received the king's forgiveness, and I'm not sure that he deserved that, though I must say I'm not sure that we can count David not killing Shimei as a totally undeserved grace. Shimei had been wrong in what he had said about David, but his wrongdoing had not been a sin deserving of death. So David showed restraint in not killing Shimei, but I'm not sure that we would call that either a mercy or a grace, so much as just forgiveness. Himham, however, does represent an undeserved grace. It is grace when a person receives a good thing which he did not deserve. So far as we know, Chimham had done nothing to deserve David's favor. Barzillai had done much for David, but we don't know that Chimham had done anything for him. However, Barzillai would not receive the reward for the good that he had done. Instead, he passed that reward on to his servant Chimham. Chimham would have a place near the king. Barzillai would not be able to taste the delicious food or hear the voice of the singers, but Chimham would have these unmerited pleasures. Now again, I don't think that the original author of this account intended this as an allegory, so we shouldn't build any theological doctrine directly on Chimham's story. However, when John wrote Revelation and told us of Christ's return, I do not doubt that he had the ideas behind this story in mind. The imagery of Christ as a returning triumphant king surely does mirror the return of his ancestor David to the throne. And for that reason, I think that when we look forward to Christ's return, we also should look forward to a day of celebration like Israel had, in which Christ's followers also will receive undeserved pleasures, as Chimham did. On the topic of Barzillai, I think that we should briefly note that life is full of good pleasures, and that if we, like Barzillai, live to an old age, we also will lose our ability to enjoy many of the pleasures of life. Let us be sure, then, to enjoy them while we have them. We should not focus ourselves on the pleasures of this life at the expense of the next. We should not love our pleasures more than we love our neighbors. However, we should rightly and morally receive the good gifts of God in this life with thanksgiving while we can. The appreciation of the good pleasures of life are a theme of the book of Ecclesiastes, where, for example, we have it at chapter 12, verse 1, that we should remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. That verse is followed by a list of poetic images of the ravages of age. So let us enjoy the good things that we have while we have them, and be sure to fear God in doing so. Another lesson that we find in Absalom's rebellion is the way in which people tend to follow the crowd, particularly when their heads are at stake. We should learn not to follow the crowd if they go the wrong way, and also we should learn to fear the crowd when they do. In a very short period of time, the majority of Israelites apparently went from loving David and wanting him to be king to being prepared to kill David on the battlefield, and then to loving him again and wanting him as king again. It is amazing that people could make such drastic swings so quickly. The catalyst for the swing, of course, was Absalom's seizure of the throne. Before Absalom seized power, loving David was the safe option and hating David was the dangerous one. But with Absalom in power, and power in this case meant having a growing number of supporters, loving David became the dangerous option, and hating David became the safe one. Once Absalom was dead, this switched back again. People rallied to David. David had the power, and suddenly loving him was safe, and hating him was dangerous. The people of Israel at that time, and unfortunately people everywhere at all times in general, tend to be more interested in following the crowd than in maintaining a principled stance. Crowds of people have power. The crowd is strong enough to hang you, or alternatively, is collectively wealthy enough to grow your customer base and keep your business afloat. A young man with many friends finds a wife among them. A young man with many enemies has one sitting on the jury to convict him. All too often it is the case in the end that getting along with the crowd is the difference between comfort and misery, and even life and death. For this reason, people tend to watch the crowd and to go the way that the crowd is going, that they may have its support and not face its wrath. However, we know that following the crowd often is not good. Following the crowd isn't a problem in superficial matters, but in issues of moral or theological importance, Christians must stand firm on our principles rather than caving to outside pressures. There is a definitive standard of right and wrong which is expressed in the Scriptures. The Scriptures should govern our view of the crowd, not the other way around. Truth is not relative, that it should be defined by the majority opinion. As believers, we cannot bend our faith to follow the crowd. But let us recognize that a refusal to bend will be received poorly. If the crowd wants bad and we as believers insist on doing good, then the crowd will hate us for getting in their way, and they will act on that. Unfortunately, we live in times when the crowd is often wrong. And if that trend continues unabated, we should be fully prepared as Christians to suffer for our faith. Christ served as an example for us in this. He was taken away and hanged on a cross. He could have bent to the world and avoided this fate, but he didn't. Neither did his followers. The apostles faced imprisonments, beatings, and death. They stayed on the path of suffering for the truth. Let us then do likewise. To conclude, as David fled Jerusalem at the beginning of the rebellion, he encountered a number of different characters, and on his return, many of those same characters appeared to receive him. Today's passage wrapped up their stories, and they also gave us some interesting insights into human behavior and its ramifications for our faith. Barzillai reminds us that our lives are short and that we should enjoy the good in them while we can. The elders and the people of Israel remind us to beware following or being overcome by the fickle attitudes of the crowd. And in looking at the return of David, the proto-Messiah, to his throne, we cannot avoid making comparisons to the ultimate return of Christ to his. We see forgiveness granted to penitents like Shimei. We see unmerited favor granted to Chimham. And in Mephibosheth, we see a man who obtains a reward which he could never have earned, and we find in him a gratefulness for that and a single-minded devotion to it, which allows him to set aside the loss of other things. Let us learn from his example. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.